two major economies have just defaulted on their sovereign debt. And this has thrown global markets, global financial markets into some sort of a tizzy. Now, not both are major economies. One is a major power, that is Russia. Russia is a unidimensional superpower, that means a military superpower. It's also a unidimensional economic power, not a superpower, unidimensional economic power in the sense that most of it, its earnings come from natural resources, mainly minerals, particularly oil and gas. So one is that, plus it's now involved in such an important war, which is redefining all the global power balance and equations. And the other is not such a large economy, but is very important for us in India because it's our next door neighbor, that is Sri Lanka. So on the same day, both these economies, both these countries have defaulted on their sovereign debt. Now, these two defaults are of different types, and we'll try and understand that because it's also taken me some time figuring this out. And in the process, I have learned new things, which I'll try and share with you, because every time you read up on stuff like this and you try and understand this, you realize how little does one know. All of us think we are sab janta walas, but we don't know. There is so much that we don't know. And frankly, truth to tell, one contribution Cut the Clutter is making to my life is making me more curious and making me learn about new things. For example, why Sri Lanka's default is like a total default and why Russia's default is like a partial default or not a total default. I will explain that to you. Now, first of all, let me ask you, what happens? Forget banking, finance, technicalities, jargon. What happens when a human being defaults on debt? If you and I default on debt, say on a motor vehicle or a car or a scooter, or a house, then what happens? First month, your installment doesn't go. Next month, some officer from the bank arrives at your home, gives you a warning, and if you can't do it early enough, then they repossess, as they say, your car or your bike or your house or any asset that you may have bought against that loan or whatever you may have offered as collateral. So they possess your collateral. In fact, if you look at your newspapers these days, one indication that middle class in India has suffered really badly during the pandemic is see these full page ads, half page ads from gold loan companies auctioning the gold mortgage with them, because people who mortgage this gold, their family silver and jewels essentially, against high cost loans and have not been able to pay back, that jewelry is being sold. So that is what they do. Again, if a company defaults, what happens? You know, in the past, they would all run away. So you have the Nirav Modi's, Vijay Mallya's, Mehul Choksi's, ABG Shipyard, all that. Some still run away. But others, most of the others, go to what is called as bankruptcy process. And in that bankruptcy process, all their assets are collected, whatever remains of their assets, those are valued and those are sold, and whatever comes back is then distributed amongst the various lenders. In most cases, lenders get less than what they are owed. And that difference between what they are owed with interest and what they actually get, that difference is called a haircut, right? So you say, oh, banks have taken 30% haircut, 10% haircut. Although in case of many companies we have seen, banks have taken not just a haircut, but the equivalent of a mundan or a tonsuring. Now, you can do this to companies. You can also repossess the collateral of individuals. You can auction the remaining assets of a company net of the liabilities. But what do you do when a country goes bankrupt? Can you auction a country? Can you repossess a country? Can you say, your country was my collateral, I'm taking over? It doesn't happen, although we've seen in some places China doing a little bit of that. That, you know, you built this asset with our money. They did that to Sri Lanka famously in our neighborhood. That you built this Hambantota port with our money. And because you are not able to repay your debt, I am taking this port. This is now mine. So that is for individual assets. But again, not many countries do it. Very few countries do it. And this is the reason now nations are getting more and more concerned about the debt they've taken from China, and this particularly applies to Africa and also our other neighbor, namely Pakistan. Bangladesh has now become very cautious about Chinese debt. Now, if you are not China, how do you deal with the country's debt? Even for the Chinese, there are limitations to it. If you give money for a specific project which can yield revenues, you might take that project, if at all, although it's now looking uglier and uglier by the day. But you can't take over a country. So when that happens, then lenders and the borrowing defaulting country have to get together and they have to find a solution. So usually what happens is, once again, you can't send your army and navy to the country. It's not as if all the people who bought bonds from Sri Lankan government, Sri Lanka sovereign bonds, they can ask their governments to go and raid Sri Lanka. It doesn't work like that. You have to then sit down and you have to negotiate. When you negotiate after a default, you can ask for a loan forgiveness. You can ask for a loan extension of tenure. You can ask for a reduction on the ticket, that means on the interest rate. These are the negotiations that go on. But a country that defaults suffers severely. Why? Because lending to it becomes even more risky for people who have spare money going ahead. So interest rates, the risk factor on lending to it becomes higher, which means interest rates become higher. I will tell you how it works. If you are in the financial markets, you know this. Nevertheless, Sri Lankan bonds, which were a bunch of which were coming up for repayment or for interest payment just yesterday, that is Wednesday this week, those were trading last week at 59 cents to a dollar, which means people in the market were already considering the possibility of the money not coming back 41%. I don't know how much they are trading at now. Although you would think sovereign bond, sooner or later the country will repay. Somehow or the other, or somebody will bail out the country. Yet, this is how the risk goes up. And as the risk goes up, interest rates go up. That is why some countries are able to raise debt at very low rates. Look at America, for example. The entire world is buying American bonds and thereby funding the American deficit, because America prints the world's reserve currency. That's the dollar. That rate is very low. But at the same time, if, say, Sri Lanka goes out to borrow money right now in the market, in any case, they would have had to pay high interest and now even higher. Once again, see the example of Pakistan. The rate at which Pakistan borrows from China is about more than twice as much as they would pay for sovereign borrowings from multilateral institutions or other nations. So Chinese also charge high interest rates because they also know, one, that the lender is desperate, second, that there is risk. So once you go to restructure your debt, saying, look, boss, I can't pay, take pity on me. There is a sacrifice in sovereignty, because the lender then says, all right, be a good boy, going ahead, do this, don't do this, do this, don't do this. So that is loss of face and sovereignty. Cost of your future borrowings goes up even higher. It's also a hit to your sovereign decision making. I said you take a loss of sovereignty. And your growth goes down, poverty goes up, and you are left with less and less money to spend on infrastructure, railways, highways, health, education, poverty support, all of that. So this really is an awful thing to happen to a country. And not many countries face this disaster. I think Argentina did this about 25 years ago. Among major countries, but it doesn't happen all the time. Now, where do we get a lot of this data from? I picked up some of it from the publications and websites of IMF and World Bank, which have a lot of data, particularly on debt, because they've been very concerned about debt in the global in the global situation. And some has come from this thread of tweets, long thread of tweets from David McNair, who's a fellow at Carnegie Endowment, but also executive director of global policy at an NGO called One Campaign. One Campaign actually targets or aims for extreme poverty and preventable disease eradication by 2030. So it's an anti-poverty NGO. And a lot of the explanation also lies in these tweets and also data. Again, if you look at this data and you go back to IMF and World Bank data, you can see it doesn't look as if Sri Lanka and Russia may be only by themselves in this bad category for too long. Because a lot of other countries in the world, at least 30 countries in the world, according to this IMF chart, which you will see on my screen, are in extreme danger of defaulting. And if that happens, you know what will happen with the global financial system. It so happens that a majority of them are in Africa. A majority of them have a lot of debt to the Chinese. But debt has now become a big threat. Among nations which now face this extreme threat, there is one more in our neighborhood. That's a nation you would expect to be in trouble. That's Afghanistan. I don't know what anybody can recover from Afghanistan in the short run or in the long run. There is also Tajikistan. Uzbekistan also is in trouble. So many of these countries are now in trouble. Why has this happened? This has happened because too many negatives have combined at the same time. First of all, came COVID. Even before COVID, these countries had their debt burden going up. If you look at Africa, for example, Africa's monthly debt servicing cost had quadrupled since 2010. So their debt burden was already going up. Then came COVID. COVID meant economies shut down. COVID also meant that these countries, which basically earned their income by exporting resources, the need for those resources, minerals, etc., even oil came down. And as that happened, these countries' income came down. So you had the economies tanking, sudden fall in revenue, and cost of debt that went up. We saw globally interest rates started going up. Also, too many of these countries had too much debt already, and they had been evergreening their debt. Sri Lanka had been doing that. In some ways, Pakistan has been doing that in our neighborhood. Although Pakistan is not in this endangered list as yet. But Pakistan has also been evergreening its debt. They've also taken oil, petroleum on debt from Saudi Arabia, for example, at very high interest rates, again, against very daunting collaterals. We had spoken about that in an earlier Cut the Clutter. Now, Sri Lanka, Pakistan, most of Africa, they are now mostly peaceful zones. They are not involved in a war. But in a globalized environment, what happens when a big war breaks out, particularly one involving a big exporter of energy in the world, among the biggest exporters of energy and natural resources, that being Russia. And Russia faces sanctions. When that happens, then prices of many things go up across the world, including food. The world is now seeing over the last 2 years, and now it's peaking, very high food inflation. The price of wheat, for example, in the last 3 years has nearly doubled from $200 a metric ton to about $400 a metric ton. Edible oils are going up, pulses are going up, everything is going up all over the world. These are essential foods that the poor need as much as the rich do, except that the poor don't have the money and the poor countries don't have the money. And now to buy this food, they have to pay a lot more money. That's why you see again and again, day after day, more ships going from India, offloading rice, sugar and other grains, etc. in Sri Lanka, because that is to give them the cushioning from having to spare foreign exchange to buy this right now. All this is being done against credits that India has offered Sri Lanka. Now, we know debt can be from many sources of many kinds. A debt between nations can be from another nation. That is Pakistan taking debt from China, India taking debt from Japan. For example, Delhi Metro, part of Bombay Metro, Ahmedabad, Mumbai bullet train. All these are being built with Japanese loans of what is called as JICA, J-I-C-A, their loans. This is one country lending to another. And now India is lending to Sri Lanka, India lends to Nepal, India lends to many countries in Africa and elsewhere also. That is country to country. Second is what is called as multilateral debt. So when you borrow from World Bank, from IMF, Asian Development Bank, AIIB, Asian Infrastructure Bank, these are all multilateral debts, which means these are organizations which collect money from many countries and then as financial institutions like banks, lend a country the money. And the third, that is where Sri Lanka and Russia have both got into trouble immediately, is the sovereign bond debt. That is, countries float their bonds and investors across the world then weigh these bonds and see, they say, what's my risk? What's my risk-benefit ratio? And that determines the interest. Riskier the bond, higher the interest. Safer the bond, lower the interest. And these bonds are then traded. So it is this debt which is owed to the private sector. Now you can go to another nation and say, boss, I am a nation. What happens if I evaporate? I can't evaporate. Nah. I don't have money to pay you. Please restructure it. You can go to World Bank, IMF. World Bank might be nicer to you, kinder to you. IMF may say, you do this, but you follow these conditionalities from me. You clean up your act on the economy, stop all your populist schemes, raise your tax rates, or in some places, cut your tax rates. So you make those compromises. But if these are private lenders who have money from investors so that they can make some profit for investors and keep a part of that as their commission. You have PIMCO and Invesco, for example. These are global financial institutions, multinational financial institutions, which collect money from their investors to earn returns on it. They are among the biggest investors in the bonds, Russian bonds, on which the Russian government has defaulted. Now, on these bonds, these governments will have to pay interest at periodic intervals and also the principal back. That is what the Russians and the Sri Lankans have failed to do. Now, why did I say that in one case, Sri Lanka's case, it's full default. In Russia's case, it's partial default. That's because Sri Lanka simply cannot pay. It doesn't have any money. Russians can pay, but they cannot pay in dollar because they have the dollars available with them. But bulk of their foreign exchange reserves, they can't access now because of the US and EU sanctions. So they have the money, but the vault is locked up and keys with somebody else. That somebody else is the powers which have imposed the sanctions. So Russians are saying, look, I can give you money back, but I'll give you your money back in rubles, right? I have enough rubles. I'm not short of money. I can't pay you dollars. So it's a partial default because nobody would take money back in rubles. Russians, on the other hand, are now saying that, look, this is our money. We are not being given access to it. And a lot of the defaulted bonds are in UK. So we will file cases in courts there, saying that we should be allowed access to our own money. So we don't know how that goes, but of the $40 billion that the Russians have in these bonds, these sovereign bonds, about half are held by investors overseas. So that's caused a big problem and a big embarrassment to Russia also. But Russia isn't broke in the sense that Sri Lanka is broke. That is the difference we must understand. Now, when COVID came, global financial institutions, World Bank, IMF, they had figured that there was going to be a problem. And because there was going to be a problem, some proactive steps had been taken. So in 2020, for example, a new program was designed called DSSI, that is Debt Service Suspension Initiative, under which many of these countries, which were stressed under debt, and now they were hit by COVID, they were hit by rising prices, they were given relief. So this DSSI meant that World Bank, IMF, they went to various countries and institutions and said, listen, these countries, let them have the money to spend on medicines, on vaccinations or whatever, or giving food to their people. It'll be unfair to expect them to pay now. So you defer their loan repayment. This is not loan cancellation, not loan forgiveness, not haircuts. They said you give them loan deferment, payment deferment. Under that program, say about $12.9 billion worth of loans were deferred. Now, if you see the list, it's a lot of countries, but it's also interesting that these countries include, in our neighborhood, Pakistan. Sri Lanka is not on the list, probably because Sri Lanka was already too far gone to be able to qualify for this. But the 2020 calendar year, Pakistan had debt deferred to the extent of 0.5% of its GDP. That is about $1,265 million. And in calendar year 2021, this deferred debt had risen to $5,231 million. That is about 1.9 9% of Pakistan's GDP. So countries did benefit from this. But again, data tells us that many countries, particularly in Africa, were too far gone to qualify even to fall under this bracket. So they are now also in trouble. And then, you know, what happens? In Hindi, there is a saying, Kangali mein aata gila. That means when you've really fallen on bad days, you don't even have food to eat at home. And then you find that your roof is leaking and the little bit of wheat flour you have in your house, that's also got wet, right? That's also got ruined. So that's called Kangali mein aata gila. I'm sure in every language in India, there is a native line of wisdom that says something like that. So, duniya bhar ka kangali mein aata gila ho gaya, because on top of all this came the war. So, pandemic, which refuses to go away, the war, already rising food prices, and then an energy crisis. All of this has come together. And what's happened with Sri Lanka actually is just the canary in the coal mine, as we say. Sri Lanka now has to go to IMF and accept nothing short of a full structural change or shift or a restructuring of its economy of the kind that it had in 1977-78. That, by the way, did not work out that badly for Sri Lanka. Sri Lanka reformed its economy and did very well. Second, Pakistan, now that they've had a change in the government, that government will have to withdraw many populist policies to get their money from IMF, to get the next tranche from IMF. Pakistan also is an IMF-addicted country. Sri Lanka also is, but not as much as Pakistan. Pakistan is fully an IMF-addicted company. It has to go there every few years. If my count is right, in about the past 30 years, this will be Pakistan's 13th or 14th IMF bailout. And Russia is fully something that is linked to the geostrategic situation. As I said earlier, Russia is a partial default, not a full default. They have a 30-day grace period beginning April 4. That means within 30 days, they can repay this stuff in dollars. But if the war goes on, as it looks like it will go on, it's unlikely that sanctions will be loosened. If anything, sanctions will be strengthened. And you know what? What are the Americans, the Europeans saying? They're saying, look, you can't even pretend that you don't have the money to pay in dollar. So many countries, particularly in Europe, are allowed still to buy your energy against hard currency. So why don't you use that money, that hard currency, to pay your debt? What then happens is, if the Russians do that, they have even less money left with them to finance the war. So that is again something which is like a price the Russians have to pay for defaulting on their debt, even if it's a partial default. Now, one more final question. People keep asking, and there's a lot of debate about whether IMF policies are good or not, whether it's good for a country to borrow from IMF or not, whether nations' economies are destroyed by IMF policies or shored up by IMF policies. To which my question is, why do nations go to the IMF? Nations go to IMF because they've been irresponsible. They've been irresponsible, profligate. They've spent money where they should not have spent it. They've been incompetent, inefficient in collecting their taxes. But the biggest reason is because in many of these countries, the elites are corrupt. So even when they take loans, the earlier loans, a lot of that leaks, a lot of that stolen, or it is spent on vanity projects, and that just eats up money without creating any revenues. And that is when countries reach the IMF. It's only when the countries have been irresponsible and been going on like aamdani athanni kharcha rupaiya kind of situation that they land up with the IMF. So the best way of avoiding going to the IMF, because you don't like the conditions that IMF will put, those will be very onerous, is to live responsibly, to live within your means. Because if you live irresponsibly and you have to go for a bailout, then the lender has every business to ask you questions and to lay down conditions.